From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Until very recently, most Americans had probably never heard of the Defense Production Act, a law that's been on the books for 70 years and used hundreds of thousands of times. Here's President Harry Truman announcing the signing of the DPA in 1950.
This law also will enable the government to make sure that defense orders have top priority, that manufacturers get the steel, aluminum, copper, and other materials they need to fill such orders. This law gives the government the power to prevent the hoarding of raw materials essential to defense.
Well, that definition of defense is broader now than it was in 1950. It includes energy security and national disasters, say, like a global pandemic. So this hour on Point, we ask, what exactly is the Defense Production Act? When has it been mobilized in the past and what for? And more importantly, how is it working today as the nation confronts a new national challenge? And we'll start with Margaret O'Mara. She's a professor of history at the University of Washington. She worked in the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services in the Clinton administration. And she's author of a recent opinion piece in the New York Times headlined, America is at War and There's Only One Enemy. Professor O'Mara, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Megan. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. First of all, let me ask you, what was happening in the late 1940s and 1950 that led to the passage and signing of the Defense Production Act?
Well, Megan, it was a very different time and political challenge. It was the heating up of the Cold War. This is the Soviet threat is something that is premier on American policymakers' minds and President Truman's minds. 2 months before the before Truman announces that signs the Defense Production Act, North Korea's Soviet-made tanks had rolled across the 38th parallel, and the Korean War had begun. And the kind of the very real threat of Soviet increased Soviet domination of the globe was something that was primary on Truman's mind. And so that was really, you know, containing communist aggression, as Truman put it, was the main purpose, and saw the mobilization of American industry as essential. But it was a very bold move, kind of putting America on a wartime footing when it wasn't officially at war.
Interesting. So the looming political threat of communism as seen by 1940s, 1950 America. And when you say it was a bold move, I mean, what about the Defense Production Act was so bold for the time?
Well, it was a real, gave the president pretty sweeping powers ultimately to manage the economy, to direct industrial production, to prioritize the production of raw materials, and also, to make sure that there were raw materials to build the armaments needed, and also to tell factories, okay, you're not going to produce as many consumer goods, you're going to produce defense goods. And it also involved raising taxes. Truman, in announcing it, kind of emphasized, we're going to pay as we go. We're going to have to, every American's going to have to make some sort of sacrifice. But the other backdrop to this was economic. After World War II, there was great concern that the U.S. would, very legitimate concern, that the U.S. would go back into the Great Depression. The wartime mobilization of the early 40s had kind of gotten people off the unemployment lines for real for the first time. And so what the rationale for the DPA was also that revving up our defense production could also be really great for the American economy. It could put people to work. It could help businesses get their production lines at full capacity and keep them there.
Interesting. So, this is a way in which the federal government then is what, directing the key industries in the economy, unlike it had before?
Yeah. Well, the DPA had a template, and that was the War Powers Act that Franklin Roosevelt had used to mobilize industry during World War II as the U.S. is ramping up and then formally engaging in it. So there was a precedent, but of course it was during a world war. So this was a departure. And also initially the DPA included things like wage and price controls, like really trying to keep inflation from under control, all these policy instruments that were baked into it. Now that was pretty short-lived. And Truman, and to be clear, this was not something that was universally welcomed. I mean, Truman's moves to really fully implement the DPA in late 1950 were met with some, you know, dissent in Congress and concern about that he was taking too much. And then when Eisenhower became president a couple of years later, he actually backed off a little bit off the DPA, took away some of the authorities the president had to kind of tell industrialists what they can pay people and how much they could charge for their goods.
Okay, so dissent over that level of control, those wage and price controls you were talking about.
Yeah,
so just to underscore, those went away pretty quickly, but the Defense Production Act though still has been reauthorized multiple times by Congress. And in fact, as I mentioned at the beginning, the definition of the national defense under the DPA has broadened in the past 70 years.
That's right. It has broadened and it's been reauthorized continually. And it's kind of shifted with the times, just as it was the product of 1950. It's been updated over time to reflect what the national security concerns were of the moment. In the early 1970s, Richard Nixon used it first to reintroduce wage and price controls again, as he's trying to stabilize a changing American economy and global economy. And also during the oil crisis of the 1970s, it was used to ensure that there was that was an essential. It was considered essential to national security to amid the OPEC oil embargo of 1973, 1974. That we have these moments where it's been used for energy crises. It's been invoked for national security. National security, as you said, has had kind of an expansive definition over the years, and it's no longer just aluminum and copper for airplanes.
So with the global pandemic of COVID-19, given the history of how the Defense Production Act has been used over the past 70 years, do you think this is a moment for the DPA to be used in its fullest force or its fullest potential?
I think this is, yes. What we're seeing here is the critical need for national level mobilization. In the last 10 days, we see these states kind of competing against one another for vital materials. You see prices being driven up. You see people profiteering off of this crisis. And having, the DPA is a very powerful act. And I think one of the things that is eye-opening about it and really reflects, American presidents have a great deal of power, and this is a very powerful tool that's in the president's arsenal. But it's there for a reason, and it can be can create order out of chaos and rationalize this production chain in a way that will deliver things faster to more people.
Order out of chaos. Interesting. So, folks, we are talking about the Defense Production Act this hour, and we want to know what your questions are about how it has been used in the past, what the intent of the DPA is, and your questions about how it's being used right now in the battle against the global pandemic of COVID-19. Margaret, if you can just hang on here for just a moment, I want to introduce now into the conversation Steve Vladek. He joins us from Austin, Texas. He's an expert on constitutional law, national security law, and federal jurisdiction. He's a professor at the University of Texas Law School as well. Professor Vladek, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Magda. Great to be with you.
So we have news today that the Department of Health and Human Services is announcing a $490 million contract with General Motors for 30,000 ventilators to be delivered to the Strategic National Stockpile by the end of August, so by the end of the summer. But it's the first contract, apparently, for ventilator production under the Defense Production Act. That just happened today. So what would you say, or how would you rate the Trump administration's use of the DPA prior to today and over the past month?
Well, I think prior to today, the answer would have been zero. And I think, with today, maybe we're up to a 1.5. I mean, I think the broader problem is, as Professor O'Mara suggested, there are these sort of spectrum of authorities under the statute. And it's not just that the government has been unwilling to use even the most coercive of these authorities, which is basically to create these strong financial incentives for companies to shift production into other goods and services, is that it hasn't even been willing to use the weak version, which is just that the government gets priority in contracts, which is apparently what we saw this morning with HHS and GM. You know, imagine it's April 8th. It's been 68 days since Secretary Azar declared a public health emergency. It's been 3 weeks since President Trump said he was invoking the DPA. And here we finally have a little bit of movement that, you know, to my mind, is too little and way too late.
Well, could it possibly, could there be credence to the Trump administration's and the president in particular, his reluctance to use the heavy hand of government in the free market? I mean, as Professor O'Meara was saying to us earlier, there has been some concern from the start that the DPA could be a tool of federal overreach in the American economy.
I mean, I think that's certainly a concern. And I think, you know, we can look at some of the past invocations of the statute and wonder if it was really necessary. But when we have this kind of unprecedented nationwide public health crisis combined with a clear, as Professor O'Meara described it, you know, capacity problem, where different jurisdictions are now basically competing with each other and bidding against each other for the same scarce resources, you know, it seems to me that that's exactly what the DPA was designed for. And more to the point, it seems like the efforts by the Trump administration to characterize this as nationalizing these industries is a pretty radical mischaracterization of the statute. I mean, the most coercive authority under the statute is an authority where the executive branch has the power to create remarkably powerful financial incentives for industry to do what the federal government needs. You know, Meghna, I don't see that as the strong hand of government. I see that as the rich purse of government. And that seems wholly consistent with our values.
Well, Steve Vladeck and Margaret O'Meara, stand by for just a moment. We are talking about the Defense Production Act, what it is, what it's intended to do, and how it's being used today. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are holding up a magnifying glass to the Defense Production Act this hour, trying to understand what its original intent was, how it's been used. And by the way, it has been invoked hundreds of thousands of times in the past 70 years by every administration that's occupied the White House, and what it could be used for today in the fight against the global pandemic of COVID-19. I'm joined today via Skype from Seattle by Margaret O'Meara. She's a professor of history at the University of Washington. And Steve Vladeck joins us from Austin, Texas. He's a professor at the University of Texas Law School. Now, Professor O'Meara and Professor Vladeck, here's what I'd like to do in sort of like taking that magnifying glass to the DPA. Margaret, with you, I want to ask about the individual titles of the DPA that remain. And then, Steve, I'm going to turn to you and ask how those titles have been specifically utilized right now by the Trump administration with particular companies. OK, so it's almost like we're having a tag teaming teaching moment here. Is that OK with both of you?
Sure.
OK, sure. Great. Because I just really want to understand the details here, because that's where the devil supposedly always lies. Now, Margaret, from what I understand, of the original seven parts of the DPA from 1950, we've got three that remain, Title 1, 3, and 7. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's right.
Okay, so Title 1 contains these priorities and allocation authorities from the executive. Mm-hmm. What does that mean?
Well, that means that the executive branch can kind of ensure that there's a portion of whatever industry is producing that is retained but for national security uses or defense uses. So in a way, it's saying, you know, you can't produce all of your ventilators, for example, and send them to whatever customer will pay the highest price. We are essentially going to be a we're going to hold them back. Now, one of the things about all of these titles is that these are all a combination of carrots and sticks. Mm-hmm. So this is, and I think this is why the DPA has worked, and why it's, and this is really a hallmark of the way that the U.S. government does business with business. It is both incentives. It's like, look, we're going to buy this stuff from you and we're going to pay you for it. You know, it's not that you're not going to make a profit. It has been very profitable to do business with the government over time. But we also are going to tell you, you know, you just can't just do what you want. There are higher priorities.
Okay. So then it should come perhaps to no one's surprise that the Defense Department itself is the most frequent user of this Title I portion of the DPA, right? Mm-hmm. Like I'm seeing here that in 2018, it just, the DOD itself used it 300,000 times to be sure that it had access to the materials and goods needed for the United States military. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's Title I. So Steve, let me jump over to you here. We've been told that the Trump administration invoked the Defense Production Act, say, to 3M for the production of masks and personal protective equipment. How did they use Title I regarding 3M?
So, I mean, this is where things, I think, get messy because uh-huh. of how the headlines are actually diverging somewhat from what the administration actually did.
Right.
So in a memorandum that was issued last Thursday, the president said that he was directing the Secretary of Homeland Security to use any and all authority available under the DPA to acquire from 3M the number of N95 respirators that the administrator determines to be appropriate. And so, you know, if we look at that provision, what that basically says is, hey, Secretary of Homeland Security, you figure out how many of the respirators already in 3M's possession we, the federal government, need. I'm hereby authorizing you to buy them. And that's a Title I measure because it's not asking 3M to produce anything new. It's just putting the federal government at the front of the line to buy the resources that are already in 3M's possession.
So it used Title I then appropriately in that case, is it? Did it?
Well, we don't know, right? Because, Magna, the problem is that what the president keeps doing is he keeps issuing these memoranda that direct other members of his administration to take particular steps if they decide certain, you know, preconditions are present. And we're not hearing much about the follow-up, right? That is to say, the president is not ordering action. He's authorizing action and then deferring to his subordinates. And it's just not clear from a lot of these headlines how much these subordinates are actually doing. Like, I don't think we've seen anything public from the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf, further to last Thursday's order specifying the exact number of respirators he wants to buy. Uh-huh. So, you know, this is the tricky part, is that it's not actually an invocation of the DPA until the Chad Wolf of the world actually exercises the authority to buy stuff from 3M, or until the, as we saw this morning, Secretary Azar signs a contract with GM to produce ventilators in a Title III context. So this is where I think the press reports have been a bit misleading, because it's not invoking the DPA to just say, hey, subordinate, when you feel like it, you can. It's just basically pulling the safety off of the gun, not firing it.
I see. But ostensibly, Margaret, the idea is that through Title I of the DPA, I hope this isn't too rudimentary an analysis of it, but it puts the federal government at the front of the line if they start saying, here's the contract we want you, Company X, to fulfill. And that's one of the powers of it.
That's right, Magna. And this is the hallmark of the DPA, and I think this is why this has been such a challenge, is, as Steve explained, it's, you know, the president can invoke something, but the actual implementation kind of happens within the bureaucracy itself, and sometimes very deeply within it, which is one reason that it's been invoked all these times, and, you know, it doesn't make headlines, right? This is one of the things, and one of the many, many things the federal government does, that we just, it's kind of living below the political radar screen. I think another interesting challenge is that this has indeed been primarily used by the Defense Department, as you observed. And so now it's HHS, now it's these other agencies that haven't been front and center. And the many times the DPA has been invoked, it isn't part of the regular, you know, way they do business. And so, and when you have a president and an administration that is reluctant to direct industry to the fullest extent. Look, the Truman administration had no reluctance. In December 1950, as the DPA is kind of whirling into gear, Truman appoints the president of General Electric, steps off away from his job, comes to lead this mobilization effort. And Truman's like, okay, Charlie Wilson, which is his name, you do whatever you can. Go for it. And so they went for it. And so this is a real contrast now.
Interesting. Okay. Well, so one would imagine in an ideal circumstance, though, is this not an opportunity, Margaret, for some interagency cooperation if there's a lot of body of expertise at the DOD to help out to help out HHS right now?
Yes, I would think so. The U.S. military is excellent at large-scale mobilization and logistics. They're very, very good at it. And so the fact, and, you know, the Office of Defense Mobilization was where the, you know, DPA authority rested for a very long time. And they know, you know, the military knows how to do this, but it just has not fully come together yet.
Right. So, Steve, before we step away from Title I of the Defense Production Act, I did want to ask you, one of the things that it allows the executive branch to do is, as Margaret explained earlier, is say, well, these certain materials or equipments are so important that they need to be used for government purposes, or directing companies to sell to certain places or put them in various parts of supply chains around the country. My point is that hasn't the Trump administration done this to a certain degree with 3M, again, using them as our example, by telling 3M or blocking the company from fulfilling those overseas contracts for those N95 masks?
So I think the short answer is to a point. But again, okay, and this goes back to something Professor Amara said, the devil really is in the details. And, you know, maybe that was your point, that it's one thing for the president to make this big splash and say, you know, we're going to stop 3M from fulfilling its overseas contracts. But it's another thing to see exactly what that produces with regard to the exact numbers of N95 respirators that the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, exercising the authority the president has delegated to him, actually buys from 3M, right? So this is, I mean, this is a way in which there's something, you know, that's a little bit of a trap, because on the one hand, 3M is now going to not be in a hurry to sell these respirators overseas. On the other hand, it might be very well waiting, right, for the government to figure out how many it wants to buy. And I think that's why this sort of, you know, I'm using it, but I'm not really using it approach is perhaps the worst of both worlds, where the president is claiming the authority to take these pretty big, important steps, but isn't necessarily actually using it in the first instance.
Okay. This is so fascinating. So this Title I puts the federal government and federal contracts at the front of the line, so to speak. And then in terms of sort of how the different parts of the DPA that allow for different things to happen quickly, Title III is really interesting. So, Margaret, if I understand it correctly, Title III of the DPA allows the president then to say, hey, we're going to give grants and loans to maintain this ramped up domestic production capacity for as long as it's needed. Is that right?
Yeah. So this is a great example of the carrots,
yeah.
Right? This
yeah.
is creating incentives for business to behave in a certain way and to ramp up production. And this, going back to the early years of the DPA, was really critical. I mean, what happens in the wake of the DPA is what Dwight Eisenhower later labels the military-industrial complex,
right,
like this incredible ramp up where you get to a point where defense in production is 13% of GDP. It is not only producing, you know, turning the U.S. into a military superpower, but it is employing people. It is enriching company bottom lines. And so this is the kind of classic American, this is the way the U.S., this, we have so many instances throughout American history of the way that the public sector and particularly the executive branch, since really the age of Lincoln, have used these both mandates and incentives to encourage industry to behave in certain ways and in ways that also allow private sector profit.
Do we see that carrot then, Steve, thus far in any way that the Trump administration has invoked the DPA? Again, let's like stick with the 3M example. Is it there?
I don't think we see it with the 3M example. I think the better example of the carrot is what's been going on with GM, That, you know, for all of the president's criticizing of GM on Twitter, you know, the contract this morning, I mean, a $500 million contract to GM to, you know, make a product it doesn't actually usually make in this kind of capacity. It's a pretty big carrot. I mean, the contract, I think, is for 30,000 ventilators, which works out to somewhere north of $16,000 per unit. So, you know, this is why I think the notion that the DPA is, you know, the heavy hand of government nationalizing industry really does ring a little hollow. I mean, yes, it is the government, you know, using its very persuasive pocketbook to push industries to do things they might not otherwise want to do. But no one, you know, no one's not getting paid at the end of the day. And I think that's why the GM example is such a powerful one of how the statute is supposed to work, but also why this could have happened a lot faster.
Interesting. Margaret, I'm seeing, though, that in the CARES Act recently passed by Congress, that there's a $1 billion carve out for DPA purchases through the Defense Department for medical and protective equipment. So it's there. I mean, it maybe not directly from the White House, but it's there in the DOD, right?
Yeah, it's there. I mean, the DOD had there again, these authorities are there.
Yeah.
And I do love the, you know, GM has this wonderful kind of symmetry here, of course, because during World War II, the president of GM, Roosevelt, persuaded to leave his job and run the whole mobilization effort and among other things, change GM's production line from making passenger cars to making Jeeps and tanks and other things. So it's, you know, what everything old is new again in a way. And these individual companies have a long history of working with the government, with the Defense Production Act and its predecessors.
Okay, so let's take a look at this final part of the DPA, Title VII. It seems to be the one that's most difficult for me to wrap my head around. It provides authority for the government to enter into the voluntary arrangements with private companies. What is Title VII all about, Margaret?
Well, Title VII is, again, you know, this is building new capacity where capacity doesn't already exist.
Okay.
And it's really part, I mean, this part of this broader story of the government as customer, the government as a real, you know, driver of certain types of industries, most notably the defense contracting industry, which, you know, for a solid seven decades has been a very important and profitable part of the economy. And then there have been companies, you know, like, for example, Lockheed Martin or Boeing, you know, that are both have commercial and defense, very big defense lines of business. Article 7 is one of those places where it's changed over time.
Uh-huh.
You know, there are carve outs for small businesses that emerged when it became clear that, you know, this is generally defense contracting and this type of partnership with the government, large companies, the most well-equipped to do it, particularly if you're working in these emergency circumstances, you know, you need a GM that has the resources and all of the, you know, it can, you know, do things at scale. But there's, you know, I think what it also reflects is there is an economic upside or there's an economic effect of all of this, right? This is that the defense economy is an important part, or the government-driven economy, not just defense, is an important part of the American economy. And so kind of spreading that geographically, spreading that to different types of businesses, this is something that, of course, members of Congress have been, you know, advocates of over time to make sure that, you know, it isn't all concentrated. It's in certain companies and certain geographies.
Well, so to that point, Steve, we've got about a minute and a half before we have to take a quick break. But Jane Chung in The Atlantic wrote that she sees Title VII as the tool that would have empowered the Trump administration, in her words, to turn relevant portions of a competitive market, say for masks, into a cooperative one. That is the means of bringing very quick efficiencies in emergencies like this that Title VII would have offered. What do you think of that?
I think Jane is exactly right, and I would actually commend her essay, which I think is titled "How to Actually Use the DPA."
Yes.
To everyone. You know, I think there are two parts to the story here, Magna. One is that the government has not, even as of this date, been willing to fully deploy the authorities the DPA creates, especially with regard to Title VII, but also, too, that even the deployments we're starting to see with regard to the mask order last week to 3M, with regard to the ventilator contract this morning with GM, you know, these are sort of modest half measures. And they're coming so late in the game that it's almost like, you know, these half measures would have made a lot more sense at the early part of this crisis. And if those had not been sufficient, then you see more aggressive measures that were only here today, I think, is part of why, you know, the government's response in retrospect is going to be viewed as pretty lethargic.
Well, Steve Vladeck and Margaret O'Meara, hang on here for a second. There's a lot more questions, and I will take a couple of calls as well from our patient listeners about the Defense Production Act. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we are going to be looking at the racial disparities in terms of who is succumbing to COVID-19. It's hit some communities much harder than others. And in many cities, African Americans are dying of the novel coronavirus at the highest rates. So we want to know what you're seeing. Where you live? Are you seeing those racial disparities? Leave us a voicemail at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. That's for tomorrow's show. Today, we are talking about the Defense Production Act. We're putting up a magnifying glass to it to really trying to understand holistically what it is, what it's intended to do, and how it's being used right now by the Trump administration. And I'm joined today by Margaret O'Meara. She's a professor of history at the University of Washington with us via Skype from Seattle. And Steve Vladeck also joins us. He's a law professor at the University of Texas with us from Austin, Texas. Now, just before the break, Margaret and Steve, we had talked about that Title VII of the Defense Production Act. And I wanted to just quote a little bit more from Jane Chong's really excellent piece in The Atlantic, because she sees Title VII of the DPA as, quote, allowing the executive, allowing the president to, quote, bring together industry heads and consult with persons of outstanding experience and ability to devise strategies for addressing shortages, approve voluntary agreements and plans of action that allow coordination among members of private industry, and provide businesses entering into these agreements protection from antitrust liability. So, Margaret, first of all, did we see that kind of coordination in, say, 1950 or under the Eisenhower administration?
We did. Oh, yeah. We did. I mean, this has been, you know, business leaders and big business leaders have been partners with the government in this. You know, you had presidents have typically, you know, tapped what they used to call dollar a year men, people who would leave their six figure corporates, you know, jobs as CEOs and presidents and come in and help help the Defense Department or help the executive branch mobilize, do industrial mobilization. We saw this during World War II with, again, tapping the head of General Motors to do that in the early days of the mobilization of World War II. You saw it again in the Truman years with the tapping the head of General Electric, name your big company. And so this coordinating, function is, again, very important. It's not just the bureaucrats or the military or the White House telling industry what to do. It's actually bringing having industrial leaders be part of the process and working with both as persuaders and also as bringing their business sensibility to work with business in this effort.
So in the current context, how that quick and effective synchronization of effort between industry and the government how that might come into play or why that might be important, I think has been very clearly articulated by some of our state governors. Because, for example, mm-hmm. just a couple of weeks ago, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo really pleaded with the federal government to coordinate strategies over procurement regarding equipment on to fight COVID-19. And he was saying states shouldn't be competing with each other or even with the federal government for these resources.
They could distribute those goods by need rather than having these states all compete against each other. It would also be less expensive because it would avoid the price gouging that is now happening in this marketplace. I can tell what's happening. I'll contract with a company for 1,000 masks. They'll call back 20 minutes later and say the price just went up because they had a better offer.
That's New York Governor Andrew Cuomo 2 weeks ago. Steve Vladeck, how do you respond to that?
I mean, I think the whole part of – and I think this goes back to Title I of the DPA. The part of why Congress wanted the federal government to be able to go to the front of the line was because if the federal government could basically be the sole buyer or even the principal buyer, it could set a uniform nationwide price. And you wouldn't have the situation where every jurisdiction is left basically to bid against itself and in essence basically to bid each other up. Whereas, you know, Governor Cuomo suggested, you see these prices going up. It's exactly, you know, this is where I think the federal government could have really made some positive impact earlier in the process. And I think the DPA would have been one of the ways, you know, one of the principal hooks for doing so.
Okay, well, let's take a couple of calls here. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. In a related type question, so the DPA, as I see it, is intended to acquire materials or services, right, and then distribute. So is it clear in the language of the Act or in past uses of the Act? What agency or government department then is intended or would do that coordination? Is it through Homeland Security, DHS, the FEMA?
Yeah, how would it actually work, right? Good question, Mark. I mean, Margaret, do you have an answer for him?
Well, historically, you know, in the very beginning, it was centralized. First, it was the National Security Resources Board, which is one of these early Cold War creations from the late 40s, and then the Office of Defense Mobilization in the 1950s. It's generally been centered around in the Defense Department, but it's become decentralized. I think that Mark is really hitting on this is a key issue here. And not only do we have a lot of different agencies within the federal bureaucracy, from the Department of Energy to the Department of Defense, that have it over time used this, although it's primarily been the Pentagon. But now we have making ventilators and masks. This is HHS, you know, these are very different sets of departments that are now involved in this. And they're, again, pointing to this need for coordination of a broader process at the executive level and also just simply having some federal intervention to begin with.
Mm. Let's go to Sol, who's calling from Stevens Point, Wisconsin. Sol, you're on the air.
Hello. Great to hear you. Your excellent guests have really impressed two things on me. A, logistics are the key to implementation of the DPA, and B, the Department of Defense is the most experienced using it. The president has just fired the acting inspector general for DOD, who has the most experience at this kind of thing. And I'm wondering what effect this is going to have on any implementation in the future.
You're talking about Glenn Fine, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, Sol, thank you for that question. Steve Vladeck, do you have a thought about that?
One or two. I mean, I think it's a great question. So the inspector general's principal job is not necessarily to supervise the upfront coordination and implementation, but rather to serve as an accountability mechanism to make sure that there isn't fraud or abuse or waste or illegality in how these, you know, priorities are implemented. And so I guess my concern with the sacking of Glenn Fine, with the president's apparent move to fire a whole bunch of other inspectors general, some of whom are in departments where this is a key point, is that now that we're actually seeing the government start to flex its muscles under the DPA, how can we be confident that those muscles are being flexed the right way. That is to say that the orders the government's making are above board, that there's no corruption, that there's no waste. And I think this is where having robust oversight from inspectors general is an important back-end accountability mechanism, Meghna, because that's the way to make sure that as the government's spending really a ton of money in these emergency situations, you know, it's not spending more than it needs to be, and it's not for someone's personal pecuniary gain as opposed to what's in the best interest of the country.
Well, so let me just little tangent here just for a second, because I have mentioned a couple of times during the show that the DPA has been invoked hundreds or used hundreds of thousands of times by every administration since 1950. I think, I mean, the Trump administration before COVID-19 had even had used it a couple of times, right? For example, for procuring, if I'm remembering correctly, like rare earth minerals that were that are important for a number of reasons.
And titanium sponges.
That's it. Yeah. So can you tell me more? Can you tell me more about that? Remind us about that, Steve.
Reminding implies that anyone knew about it. This goes back to where we started, which is that the DPA is actually used all the time, especially by the Defense Department. And you know, this is not sort of outside of context. I mean, on February 27th, while we were, you know, at the very sort of beginning of this crisis, there's a memorandum, you know, from the director of, from the president, right, to the Secretary of Defense and a bunch of other cabinet officials on the effect of titanium sponge imports on the national security, right? Here's a context where there's a particular good, a titanium sponge, that is of, you know, significant value to U.S. national security interests, and where to ensure that there wasn't a deficit in the supply curve, right? The president directs all of these government officials to make sure that we can make up for any shortcomings on the import side with domestic production. And, you know, that's the kind of move that was happening every day, even during the Trump administration, you know, out of sight, below the radar, where this kind of use of the statute just never provoked that much controversy. It's only now that it's in the limelight and as being, I think, to some degree, you know, over portrayed as this intrusion into private industry that all of a sudden is controversial.
Interesting. OK, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Chuck, who's calling from Methuen, Massachusetts. Chuck, you're on the air.
Hello. Who knew that it was used hundreds of thousands of times? I think all of us thought of it as, you know, ordering somebody who makes washing machines to make something for the military. I'm always concerned when national emergencies prompt individuals to want to give up their rights and when power gets more centralized. So I am all for the very discretionary and, you know, limited use. This is a unique emergency, and I don't think, again, we'll have to mobilize anyone to make masks. I think next time we'll be ready, just like we don't have to, you know, have somebody make guns because we need them. We are ready if we go to war. And I think next time we'll be ready or more ready when we go to this war, which inevitably I think we will go again.
Well, Chuck, thank you for that call. And Margaret, Chuck's comment makes me think that there is this tension. I mean, you talked about that Eisenhower warning against the military-industrial complex, right? And that the DPA was one of the tools by which we see an expansion of federal power here. I mean, is that a continued concern?
It is a continued concern, and this has been a tension in the DPA and the broader role of, I mean, military spending, but also, you know, the role of government in the economy since the 1950s. Dwight Eisenhower, you know, coined the term military-industrial complex in his farewell address that he gave as he left office in early 1961. And actually, I would encourage listeners to go look it up and read it. It's a fascinating speech, kind of what he's talking about and the worries that he's expressing. But he also, in that speech, even though he's saying we should be, you know, make sure that this sector of the economy isn't too powerful and these companies aren't too powerful, he's also saying this is necessary and essential. This is the reality we're living in. And I think Chuck's comment raises this really important, this is something we see throughout certainly modern American history, but really throughout American history, that crises, wars, pandemics prompt new ways of government, new forms of government action. out of the 1918 flu pandemic comes new ways that the U.S. addresses public health. Out of the Great Depression and out of World War II come new partnership between industry and workers and the government, and new authorities, including the Defense Production Act.
Mm. Well, since you mentioned World War II, Steve, I'm curious, and tip of the hat to my producer, Stefano Katsonis, who thought of this question. I think it's fantastic that Winston Churchill, right? None other than Winston Churchill said that America always does the right thing in the end, after having exhausted all other possibilities. Does that apply in this situation? I mean, your point is well taken, that there were a lot of there was a lot of potential in what the Defense Production Act could have assisted with earlier, a month, 2 months, 3 months ago. We started late, though. Is there some way forward now where the potential for this act to assist people on the front lines of this health disaster, that we can get that going?
I mean, I think that there's no question that the answer to that is yes, Matt. I mean, right, that if you know, the president were to have woken up today and said, you know what, we've been too timid. As of today, I'm going full bore on the Defense Production Act. Here are 20 concrete steps that I want to take over, you know, today. Yeah, I think that probably could have made a difference. But, you know, we haven't seen any evidence of that. And just to go back to the big story, you know, that you led this conversation with, the news today about the HHS contract with GM. You know, we should make sure we all are clear on the timing. The contract is to produce 30,000 ventilators sometime by the end of August.
Right.
You know, I very much hope that by the time those ventilators are produced, they're completely unnecessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but one of two things is going to be true. Either that's going to be where we end up, where we have a whole bunch of extra ventilators we did as the crisis has already passed, or we're still knee-deep in the crisis in August in a way that maybe could have been mitigated had more of this authority been used more aggressively at an earlier date.
I completely agree. I mean, we don't want to have to use them in August, but we at least will have them in the national stockpile at that time.
Oh, that's right. And that's a good thing. And that also might help us fight the next war. But, you know, we're still in the middle of fighting this one.
Right. So, Margaret, same question to you. What do you see, or given what does history tell us on what the best way forward might be now?
Well, history shows us that, you know, in prior mobilizations, there have been false starts. There have been stumbles. The ramping up of wartime mobilization and the, you know, before in the 2 years before Pearl Harbor, when the U.S. was providing armaments to Great Britain and others, it was a process of iteration, and it was not smooth. And again, the Defense Production Act was something that both, had a great impact, but also courted controversy, and something that Dwight Eisenhower modified when he came into office to kind of curb some of its really expansive provisions. So, you know, we just a false start doesn't mean that you shouldn't keep on trying and there isn't an opportunity to get it right. And I think that what history points towards is the importance of coordination, and that this is not something new. We do this all the time.
Hmm. Well, Margaret O'Meara, professor of history at the University of Washington, author of The Code, Silicon Valley and the Remaking of America. Margaret also had an opinion piece in the New York Times headlined, America is at War and There's Only One Enemy. We've got a link to that at onpointradio.org. Margaret, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was great to be here. Thanks.
And Steve Vladek, an expert on constitutional law, national security law and federal jurisdiction, and a professor of law at the University of Texas, with us from Austin. Steve, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thanks, Magna. Great to be with you.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.